face. Another one tore the blanket off his head. Greg had to throw himself face down on top of his supplies as the truck rolled down a tree-lined street and into Skardu. Greg told the truck driver to take the truck's contents to the office of Mohammed Ali Chingezi. Chingezi made a living organizing tours and mountain climbing expeditions, getting people the supplies and workers they needed. He had helped with Greg's expedition to K2. Afterward, Greg had told him about his plans to build a school. Chingezi, thought Greg, would know how to get his supplies to Corfe. Chingezi, dressed in a dazzling white shell, wore, opened the door himself and greeted Greg with a hug. Dr. Greg, he said, what are you doing here? Trekking season is over. I brought the school, Greg said. He expected Chingezi to be pleased, but the man seemed baffled. It's too late to build anything now. And why didn't you buy the supplies in Skardu? He asked. Still, he agreed to let Greg unload the truck and store the supplies in his courtyard. Then they could have tea and discuss the school. He looked at Greg's greasy shalwar and at his grimy face and matted hair, filthy from riding for 3 days on top of the truck. But why don't you have a wash first, and such like that? He suggested. Greg cleaned up and slept in Chingezi's office. The next morning, he was eager to start for Corfe. But first he ran into a visitor, Akmalu, the man who had cooked for his K2 expedition. The man reminded Greg of a promise he'd made to visit Akmalu's village, Kane. I have one jeep waiting to go to Kane village, he said. We go now. Maybe tomorrow or the next day, Greg said, looking around for his school supplies in the courtyard outside. He didn't see them. But my whole village will expect you, sir, said Akmalu. We have prepared special dinner already. Greg knew that the Balti people did not have much food to spare, and he couldn't bear the idea of making them waste a special meal. He agreed to go. Chingezi came along as well, though he didn't seem happy about it. In Kane, Greg was welcomed into a home of another old acquaintance, Zhang Junpa, a porter from his expedition to K2. As Greg settled down to a meal of fried chicken, turnip salad, and sheep liver and brains, this man began to speak. I wish to thank Mr. Greg Mortensen for honoring us and coming to build a school for Kane village, he said. A school for Kane? Greg croaked, almost choking on a bite of chicken. An argument broke out among the people of Kane about whether Greg had promised to build a school for the children of Kane or a school for the Balti porters where they could learn better techniques of mountain climbing. Greg protested over and over that he hadn't promised to do either of these things, but nobody was listening. Eventually, Akmalu led Greg to his own home, where Greg stayed the night. The next morning, Greg insisted that Chingezi take him back to Skardu before the arguments could begin all over again. Chingezi agreed and promised to take Greg to the place where the supplies for the school were stored. But instead, Greg found himself a guest in Chingezi's home village, Kwardu. Once again, there was a huge feast spread for him. Chicken, radishes and turnips, a rice dish with nuts and raisins, and a yak stew. Greg had never seen so much food in one place in Baltistan. What are we doing here, Chingezi? He asked. Where are my supplies? These are the elders of my village, Chingezi said, gesturing to several men who had joined them for the meal. Here in Kwardu, I can promise you no arguments. We have already agreed to see that your school is built in our village before winter. Greg was so angry that he got up, stepped over the food arranged on the floor, even though he knew how rude this would seem, and hurried out of the room. Outside, he ran up a steep shepherd's path until he reached a little clearing, and there he collapsed and cried, as he hadn't cried since Krista's death. How could he get a school built if he couldn't even get his supplies out of Skardu? Worse yet, he was starting to have doubts about the people of Corfe. Could they really be as good, as kind, as generous as he had remembered them? Had he just been so happy to get down alive from K2 that everything in Corfe had seemed wonderful? Maybe all the people there were like Cengezi and the other men who were trying to get a school for their own villages. Dishonest, greedy, always arguing. When Greg finally stopped crying, he looked up to see several children. They had brought a herd of goats to graze, but now they were watching the sobbing foreigner. He got up, brushed off his clothes, walked over to them, and knelt down by the oldest, a boy of about 11. "What are you?" the boy said shyly in English, reaching out to shake the stranger's hand. "I am Greg." "I am good," Greg answered, grasping the boy's small hand in his large one. "I am Greg. I am good," all the children repeated. "No, I am Greg. What's your name?" he tried again. "No, I am Greg. What's your name?" the children echoed, giggling. Greg switched to Balti, telling them that his name was Greg and that he came from America. He asked what their names were. They clapped, thrilled to understand him, and they each shook his hand as they told him their names. The girls wrapped their hands cautiously in their headscarves before touching the strange American. Greg taught them the word for foreigner, Angrezi. He taught them English words for nose, hair, ears, eyes, mouth. Half an hour later, when Cengezi found him, Greg was kneeling, drawing multiplication tables in the dirt with a stick for the children to copy. "Dr. Greg, come down. Come inside, have some tea. We have much to discuss," Cengezi pleaded. "We have nothing to discuss until you take me to Corfe," Greg said. "Corfe is very far and very dirty. You like these children. Why don't you build a school right here?" Cengezi asked. "No," said Greg. He rubbed out the numbers a 9-year-old girl had written in the dirt and corrected them. 6 times 6 is 36. "Greg, sorry, please. Corfe," Mortensen said. "I have nothing to say to you until then." Chapter 7. Corfe at Last. During the 8-hour drive to Corfe, Greg had plenty of time to think. Maybe he'd been too harsh, too angry, with Cengezi and the other men who tried to scheme and plot to get the school he'd been planning to build for Corfe. Greg was a man without a house to live in, without a car to drive, and with hardly any money in the bank, but maybe, in Baltistan, a poor section of a poor country, anyone from the United States seemed so rich that people imagined he could give them everything. If the people of Corfe started to argue or fight over what he could do for them, or tried to get him to help some of the villagers and not others, Greg would be more patient, he decided. He would listen to everyone, eat as many meals as necessary before insisting that the school would have to help every child in Corfe. It had been dark for hours by the time they arrived at the Braldu River. On the other side of the deep gorge was Corfe. The driver of the jeep honked and flashed his lights. Greg heard a shout from across the water. The jeep turned so that its headlights lit up a small figure pulling himself across the gorge in the rickety wooden box hanging from the steel cable. Greg recognized Haji Ali's son Twaha before the man jumped out of the box and crashed into him. Twaha wrapped his arms around Greg's waist and hugged him tightly. He smelled of smoke and sweat. When he finally loosened his grip, Twaha looked at the tall American, laughing. "Father mine, Haji Ali, say Allah send you back someday," he said. "Haji Ali know everything, sir." Twaha helped Greg climb into the cable car to cross the river again. It was just a box, really, Greg remembered later. Like a big fruit crate held together with a few nails, you pulled yourself along this greasy cable and tried not to think about the creaking sounds it made. Tried not to think about the obvious. If it broke, you'd fall. And if you fell, you were dead. Greg pulled himself along 350 feet of cable. The box swayed back and forth in the wind. He could feel spray in the air. 100 feet below, he could feel but not see the rushing water of the Braldu scouring boulders smooth. Then, on a bluff high over the riverbank, lit up by the jeep's headlights, he caught sight of hundreds of people waiting to greet him. It looked like everyone in Corfe was waiting for him. On the far right was an unmistakable figure, standing like he was carved out of rock, his legs planted wide. Haji Ali watched Greg make his slow way across the river. Haji Ali's granddaughter Jahan remembers that evening well. "Many climbers make promises to the Balti people and forget them when they find their way home," she said. "My grandfather told us many times that Dr. Greg was different. He would come back. But we were surprised to see him again so soon. And I was surprised to see, once again, his long body. None of the Braldu people look like that. He was very surprising." Haji Ali praised Allah for bringing Greg back and then hugged him tightly. Later, by a roaring fire in Haji Ali's house, Greg felt completely at home. He sat happily, surrounded by the people he'd been thinking about all these months. He was bursting to tell Haji Ali that he had kept his promise, but first he had to be polite and wait to be served tea. Sakina, Haji Ali's wife, brought out an old package of sugar cookies and gave them to Greg on a chip tray with a cup of butter tea. He broke the cookies into tiny pieces, took one, and passed the tray around so that everyone could share. Haji Ali waited until Greg had sipped his tea. Then he slapped him on his knee, grinning. Once again, he asked what this foreigner was doing in Corfe. But this time, Greg hadn't wandered into Corfe because he'd lost his way. He'd come with good news, and he ached to deliver it. "I brought everything we need to build a school," he said in Balti. He had rehearsed the words so that he'd get them right. "All the wood, and cement, and tools. It's all in Skardu now. I came back to keep my promise." He looked Haji Ali in the eye. "And I hope we can begin building it soon, inshallah."
"Dr. Greg," Haji Ali said in Balti, "by the most merciful blessings of Allah, you have come back to Corfe. I believed you would and said so as often as the wind blew through the Braldu Valley. That's why we have all discussed the school while you were in America. We want very much a school for Corfe."
Haji Ali fastened his eyes on Greg's. "But we have decided,
before it is possible to build a school, we must build a bridge. This is what Corfe needs now."
Greg hoped that he had misunderstood. Maybe there was a problem with this Balti.
"A bridge?" he said in English.
"Yes, the big bridge, the stone one," Twaha said also in English. "So we can carry the school to Corfe village." Greg took a long sip of tea. He took another. He was thinking hard. Chapter 8. A Bridge Before School. Sitting by the fire in Haji Ali's home, Greg's mind raced. He'd worked so hard and given up so much to get to this moment, and now he was being told that he couldn't build his school in Corfe after all. But then his thoughts slowed and settled until he felt surprisingly calm. He was disappointed, but not angry. Haji Ali was right. Of course Corfe needed a bridge. How had Greg been planning to build his school? Had he thought he'd carry every piece of plywood and every sheet of tin in a rickety wooden cable car above the dangerous Braldu River? It was himself he was angry with. He should have planned better. He decided to stay in Corfe until he understood everything he had to do to make the school possible. "Tell me about this bridge," he asked Haji Ali. "What do we need? How do we get started?" He hoped that the bridge might be built simply and cheaply. That hope didn't last long. "We have to blast many dynamite and cut many stone," Twaha began. That started off an argument among the men of the village about where to get the stone. Cut it from the mountains nearby, or have it brought in by jeep. But there was no argument about what else they'd need. Steel cable and planks of wood would have to be bought and transported to Corfe. It would all cost thousands of dollars that Greg didn't have. Greg told everyone that he'd spend his money already buying supplies for the school, and that he'd have to return to America and raise more.
He expected them to be as disappointed as he felt, but the Balti people were used to waiting. They spent half the year huddled inside, breathing the smoke from yak dung fires, waiting for the winter to pass so they could go outside again. A Balti hunter might track a mountain goat for days before he was close enough to risk shooting the only bullet he could afford. The people of Corfe had gotten very good at being patient. They didn't seem worried at all. "Thank you very much," Haji Ali said, trying to speak English. Greg was almost ashamed to be thanked for a school he hadn't brought them because he hadn't planned well enough. He hugged the old man, tight against his chest. Haji Ali beamed and told Sakina to pour Greg a fresh cup of butter tea. Greg was beginning to like the stuff more each time he tasted it. Later, Greg and Haji Ali rode along the river in a jeep, studying how bridges were constructed. Greg drew a sketch in his notebook of the kind of bridge the people of Corfe wanted, and he met with the village elders to discuss which piece of land he should build a school on when, inshallah, he returned from America. In December, nearly 2 months after he'd arrived, as snow was blanketing Corfe, Greg said his goodbyes. After visiting half the houses in Corfe for a farewell cup of tea, he bounced in a jeep back towards Skardu and the long journey home to America. Greg came back to San Francisco and began a hard time in his life. He'd been gone months longer than he'd expected. He had $83 in the bank, his girlfriend had started seeing someone else, and his boss at the hospital told him he no longer had a job. "You're one of the best we have, Greg, but if you don't show up, you're useless to me." "You're fired," he said. Even after Greg had found a new job and scraped together enough money to rent a room, things didn't get much better. Lonely, mostly broke and nearly hopeless, he felt as if he'd failed the people of Corfe. How could he get them the money for the bridge? He didn't have the courage to call Jean Herney, who had sent the money for the school, to ask for more. He didn't know what to do until a phone call gave him a new direction. The call was from Dr. Louis Reichard, the first American to reach the summit of K2. Before his own attempt to climb that mountain, Greg had called Reichard to ask for his advice. The two of them had talked from time to time since then, and Reichard knew Jean Herney. Now he'd called to ask Greg how he was. "Jean told me what you're trying to do with your school," Reichard said. "How's it going?" Greg told him the whole story, from the 580 letters to the bridge that needed to be built, from losing his girlfriend to losing his job. "Pull yourself together, Greg," Reichard said. "Of course you've hit a few speed bumps, but what you're trying to do is much more difficult than climbing K2. Coming from Lou Reichard, those words meant a lot, Greg said later. He was one of my heroes. Reichard had very nearly died in his attempt to reach the summit of K2. He knew about doing everything you could to reach a goal that was almost impossible. Hearing this man tell him that what he was trying to do was tough, but not out of his reach, made Greg think that maybe he hadn't failed. Not yet. "Call Jean and tell him everything you've told me," Reichard said. "Ask him to pay for the bridge. Believe me, he can afford it." For the first time since he'd gotten home, Greg began to feel like himself. He dug through his papers for Jean Herney's phone number. Herney had told him not to screw up. Well, maybe he had, maybe he hadn't. It depended on who you talked to. He dialed the number. And then the phone was ringing. Chapter 9. Hunting Ibex. Talking to Jean Herney had not been as frightening as Greg had expected. The millionaire had been surprisingly kind, agreeing to send a check for another $10,000. He asked for only one thing. "Get the school built as quickly as you can, and when you finish, bring me a photo," he demanded. "I'm not getting any younger." Greg promised that he would. By June 1995, Greg was back in Pakistan. In Skardu, he bargained for all the supplies he needed to build a bridge. Finally, after a dozen tries, he found someone who would sell him 5 spools of steel cable, the last item on his list. "And may I know what you want to do with so much cable?" the seller asked. "My friend's village in the upper Browdew Valley has no bridge. I'm going to help them build one," Greg explained. "Ah, you American, yes?" "Yes, sir." "I've heard about your bridge," the seller remarked. He asked if the roads to Corfe could be traveled by jeep. "If it doesn't start raining," Greg replied. "Can you deliver the cable?" "Inshallah. Allah willing." It was a good answer. Now that he had everything he needed, Greg hoped the bridge could be finished before winter. Then, next spring, work on the school could start. Greg took a jeep from Skardu to the town of Escoli. As he traveled, it started to rain, and the rain turned into a downpour. A monsoon had swept in. The jeep driver refused to continue on the muddy road from Escoli to Corfe, so Greg set off on foot. The men of Corfe met him, hours later, and took him over to the village in the hanging basket. On either side of the river, slabs of granite were stacked high. They'd been cut from the local hillsides and would be used to create the 2 towers between which the bridge would be built. At Haji Ali's house, his wife Sakina took Greg's hand in welcome. He realized that it was the first time a Balti woman had touched him. It is against tradition for a woman among the Balti to touch a man who isn't related to her, even to shake hands. The moment meant that, to Sakina, Greg was becoming like family. Sakina grinned boldly up at Greg, as if daring him to be surprised. In response, he did something to surprise her. He stepped into her kitchen, a small area of the house with a ring of rocks to hold a fire, a few shelves, and a wooden board on the floor for chopping. Normally, only the women in the house would do any work in the kitchen. Greg said hello to Sakina's granddaughter, Jahan, who giggled and tucked her headscarf over her face. As Sakina, laughing, tried to shoo him out of her kitchen, Greg filled a pot with tea leaves and water, added a few sticks of kindling to the fire, and put the tea on to boil. "My grandmother was very shocked when Dr. Greg went into her kitchen," Jahan said later. "But she already thought of him as her own child, so she accepted it. Soon her ideas changed, and she began to tease my grandfather that he should learn to be more helpful like his American son." Greg poured the tea and served it to Haji Ali and the other elders of Corfe, while Haji Ali told them how things were going with the bridge. "I was always amazed at how, without a telephone, electricity, or a radio, Haji Ali kept himself informed of everything that was happening in the Browdew Valley and beyond," Greg said. Now he told Greg and the other men gathered in his house that 2 jeeps carrying the cable for the bridge had been stopped by a rock slide about 18 miles away from Corfe. The road might stay blocked for weeks, especially in such bad weather. So Haji Ali suggested that every man in the village pitch in and carry the cable to Corfe so that the work on the bridge could begin at once. The next morning, a group of men, from teenagers to old men, set out. Greg was surprised at their cheerfulness as they walked all day in the rain to reach the stranded jeeps and then turned around again to walk 12 hours back to Corfe, this time carrying spools of cable that each weighed 800 pounds and took 10 men to lift. The men chewed tobacco and seemed happy as they marched. Working this hard to improve life in their village, rather than to help foreigners climb mountains, was a pleasure, Haji Ali's son Twaha told Greg as they walked. After they'd carried the cable to the waterside, the men dug the foundations for the bridge. But the rain continued. They couldn't pour concrete for the bridge in the rain. It wouldn't harden in the wet weather. So Twaha and some of the men invited Greg on an ibex hunt while they waited for the weather to clear. Ibex are large, muscular mountain goats with remarkable curling horns. The Balti prize the horns as much as they love the animal's meat. Sure-footed and strong, ibex can graze higher on mountain slopes than their predators, wolves and snow leopards, can travel. Greg, Twaha, and the others walked out of Corfe in a steady rain, Twaha carrying a gun over his shoulder. To Greg, the gun looked like it belonged in a museum. He couldn't believe they were really going to shoot anything with it. As they walked, Greg saw the bridge he had missed on his way down from K2, the one that led toward Ascoli. He felt cheerful, thinking how much less interesting his life would have been if he hadn't taken the wrong turn and ended up in Corfe, which now felt like his second home. Just as they reached the foot of a glacier, the rain finally stopped. Twaha reached into a pocket and took out a small round medallion woven of a colorful wool. A tomar, or badge of courage, it was meant to keep away evil spirits. Every baby born into a Balti tribe is given one at birth. No Balti would think of doing something as dangerous as crossing a glacier without a tomar. Now Twaha carefully tied the little medallion to the zipper of Greg's jacket to keep him safe on the ice. The men picked a path through shifting slabs of ice and around deep blue pools. Water echoed from inside deep cracks in the glacier surface, and the sound of rocks falling down the ice shattered the silence. Twaha pointed out the tracks of a snow leopard, and two vultures circled overhead. Greg's feet in his Nikes were soon freezing, but one of the hunters, Hussein, took handfuls of hay out of his pack and stuffed them inside Greg's shoes. That made the cold bearable. Just. It took them 4 days to spot their first ibex. It was dead, picked clean by vultures, perhaps killed by an avalanche. But high on a ledge above the bones, a herd of 16 ibex were grazing. Twaha tied the bleached skull and curving horns of the dead ibex to Greg's backpack as a present. Then they hiked up to the high ridge where the ibex were grazing. Twice they tried to circle around to find a spot where the wind would not blow their scent to the goats. But each time the herd sensed them and bounded away before they were close enough to try a shot. Just before dusk on the seventh day, Twaha spotted a big male ibex on an outcropping 60 feet above them. He tipped gunpowder and a bullet into his gun while Greg and the others pressed themselves against the base of a cliff, hoping to stay hidden. Greg saw Twaha's mouth moving in prayer as he pulled the trigger. The sound of the gun was deafening, and it brought a rain of pebbles dancing down from the heights. At first, Greg thought that Twaha had missed. Then, the ibex's front legs buckled, and it pitched over onto its side. "Allah Akbar!" the men all shouted. They butchered the ibex in a cave, by firelight, cutting up the meat and preparing it to be carried back to the village. Hussein, who had lined Greg's shoes with straw, wielded a long curved knife like an expert. He was the only one of Corfe's men who had been educated. He'd left the village to go all the way through 12th grade in a city far from the mountains. Hussein, Greg realized, would be a perfect teacher for the school once it was built. He knew all about life in Corfe, but he also knew what the children there would need to learn. By the time the hunters arrived back in Corfe, the rains had ended and the weather was crisp and clear. Twaha marched in front, holding up the head of the ibex like a trophy. Greg brought up the rear. They handed out little cubes of ibex fat to the children, who sucked on them like candy. The meat, several hundred pounds of it, was shared out among the hunters' families. Chapter 10. Building Bridges. The weather was now clear enough for work on the bridge to begin. First, two stone towers, each 64 feet high, had to be built, one on each side of the river. Four men lifted each block of stone, straining to place it straight and level on top of the cement that would hold it in place. The women took care of the crops and the fields as the men worked on the bridge. Children watched as their fathers and uncles lifted heavy slabs and shouted encouragement. Block by block, the towers rose. During the warm summer months, the people of Corfe lived outdoors as much as they could. Their two meals a day were usually eaten on the flat roofs of their houses. After a long, satisfying day of working on the bridge, Greg loved washing down a bowl of rice and lentil stew with strong tea, basking in the sun with Haji Ali's family, and chatting across the rooftops to the other families doing the same thing. On the warm, dry roofs, eating, smoking, and gossiping, Greg felt sure that, although there were many things that the Balti did not have, they did have an uncomplicated happiness that was becoming very rare in the world. At night, unmarried men like Greg and Twaha often slept on the rooftops under the stars. The two had long talks. Twaha confessed how much he missed his wife, who had died giving birth to their daughter Jahan. "Will you marry again?" Greg asked. "Oh, for me this is very easy," Twaha explained. "One day I will be Nurmadar, chief, and already I have lots of land. So far I don't love any other woman." He was curious about his friend's love life as well. "You have a sweetheart in your village?" he asked. Greg talked about the women he had dated, including the one who had broken up with him the last time he was in Pakistan. "Ah, she left you because you had no house," said Twaha. "This thing happens often in Baltistan. But now you can tell her you have a house and almost a bridge in Corfe." "She's not the one I want," said Greg. "Then you better quickly find your woman," Twaha said, "before you grow too old and fat." The day the men strung the first cable between the two towers, Greg delivered a letter. He was watching as the workers stretched the cable tightly with teams of yaks and fastened it to the towers. But he also had an eye out for a party of Americans that he had heard would be coming down the trail from the Baltoro Glacier. Then he saw the person he was looking for, a man in a white baseball cap, leaning on a walking stick with a big, muscular guide at his side. His name was George McCown, and he was the board director of the American Himalayan Foundation. It was the AHF's newsletter that had first published the article about Greg and his school for Corfe, which led Jean Herney to donate the funds for the school. McCown had spent his 60th birthday hiking to K2, and the AHF had sent him a birthday card. Not sure how to get it to him, the authorities in Escoli had handed it to Greg. They had figured one American would be able to find another. Grinning, Greg now walked over to the other American. "Are you George McCown?" he asked. McCown nodded, amazed, and Greg handed him the card. "Then, happy birthday," he said, grinning. Greg told McCown how the money for Corfe's school had been raised after the AHF's newsletter had printed an article about his project. "Greg's a guy you immediately like and trust," said McCown. "Watching all those people work with him to build that bridge, it was obvious they loved him. He operated as one of them." Greg asked McCown to do him a favor. "I was feeling out on a limb in Corfe, operating all by myself," Greg explained later. "And I wanted these people to feel like it wasn't just me, that there were a bunch of other Americans back home concerned about helping them." He gave McCown a roll of rupees and asked him to pay everybody the money they were owed for their work on the bridge, as if he were the big boss from America. "So I hammed it up," McCown said. "I walked around like a chief, paying everyone their wages, telling them they were doing a great job and to really throw themselves into it and finish as fast as they could." Greg introduced himself to McCown's guide as well. When he tried to talk to the man in Balti, the guide answered in a different language, Urdu. Greg learned he was from the Waki tribe near the Afghanistan border, and his name was Faisal Beg. McCown and Beg made their way back toward Escoli, but they didn't walk out of Greg's life. Later, Beg would volunteer to serve as Greg's personal bodyguard, and McCown would become an important supporter of Greg's work. In late August 1995, 10 weeks after they had started, the work on the bridge was at last complete. Haji Ali offered Greg the last piece of wood and asked him to lay it in place. But Greg insisted that Corfe's chief complete Corfe's bridge. Haji Ali raised the plank high over his head and thanked Allah for the foreigner he'd been kind enough to send to his village. Then he knelt and laid the board in place. The women and children of Corfe shouted their approval. Then, Greg prepared to head back to California, where he would spend the winter and spring, earning enough money to return to start building the school at last. He spent his last night in Corfe with Haji Ali, Twaha, and Hussein. Hussein had offered to donate a field that his wife Hawa owned. The school could be built there. It had a clear view of the mountain called Corfe K2, which Greg thought would encourage the students to aim high. Greg agreed if Hussein would promise to become the school's first teacher. They settled the deal over sweet tea and handshakes and talked until long after dark. Below them, lantern lights flickered over the Braldu River as the people of Corfe walked back and forth across their new bridge. For the first time, they were really connected to the outside world, the world to which Greg was getting ready to return. Before Greg left, he did one more thing. He dug 10 pegs into the frozen soil of the field Hussein had given for the school and tied red and blue nylon cord to them, marking out a plan for 5 rooms. He also left Haji Ali enough money to hire workers from nearby villages to cut stone and carry it to Corfe. They should be able to lay a foundation or base for the school before Greg came back. Chapter 11. 6 days. Back in the United States, Greg visited John Herney in Seattle and brought him pictures of the bridge as promised. "I was afraid of John at first," he admitted, "but he couldn't have been kinder to me." Greg unpacked his duffel bag, and soon he and Herney were bent over a coffee table studying photos, architectural drawings, and maps. Herney had trekked to K2 base camp twice, and he and Greg talked about all of the villages that, like Corfe, didn't appear on maps. Herney was very pleased to be able to draw in black marker the new bridge over the Braldu River on a map. Jean really responded to Greg right away, Herney's wife Jennifer Wilson remembered later. He appreciated how goofy and unbusinesslike Greg was. Jean had accomplished a lot in his life, but the challenge of building the Corfe school excited him just as much as his scientific work. He really felt a connection to the region. "After Greg left, he told me, 'I think this young guy has a 50-50 chance of getting the job done. And if he does, more power to him.'" Back home in San Francisco, Greg called up George McCown, the man whose birthday card he had delivered, as he walked by the bridge to Corfe. McCown invited him to a special dinner given by the American Himalayan Foundation to honor Sir Edmund Hillary, who, along with Tenzing Norgay, had been part of the first team to climb Mount Everest. Greg said he'd see him there. On September 13, 1995, Greg showed up at the fancy Fairmont Hotel. Wearing a brown sports coat that had been his father's, khakis, and beat-up leather shoes with no socks, he walked into a room filled with men in jackets and ties, women in black velvet dresses, and Tibetan Buddhist monks in cinnamon-colored robes. Greg stood near the doorway, feeling lost. Then he spotted George McCown talking with Jean Herney. George waved him over. Greg walked over to the men and hugged both of them. "I just tell George he needs to give you some fund," Herney said in his French-accented English. "Well, I should have enough already to finish the school if I keep expenses down," Greg said. "Not for the school," Herney answered. "For you! What are you supposed to live on while you get this place built?" "How does 20,000 sound?" McCown asked. Greg couldn't answer. "Shall I take that as an okay?" McCown said. "Bring him a cocktail," Herney said, grinning. "I think Greg is about to faint." Greg was stunned. He couldn't even remember much about the dinner afterward. The only thing he recalled was that the man sitting next to him was shocked to see that Greg wore no socks at such a formal dinner. He left the table and bought Greg a pair from the hotel gift shop. But Greg was able to pay attention when Sir Edmund Hillary began to speak and show slides of his 1953 expedition to Everest. "I was just an enthusiastic mountaineer of modest abilities who was willing to work quite hard and had the necessary imagination and determination," he told the crowd. "I was just an average bloke. It was the media that tried to transform me into an heroic figure. But I've learned through the years, as long as you don't believe all that rubbish about yourself, you can't come to too much harm." Greg's attention was caught even more when Hillary started showing slides of the work he'd done since his record-breaking climb, building schools and medical clinics around Everest. Greg was so excited that he couldn't sit still. Getting up from the table, he paced back and forth in the rear of the room. He wanted to hear every word that Hillary said, and at the same time, he wanted to get on the next plane that could take him toward Corfe, so he could get right to work. I have enjoyed great satisfaction from my climb of Everest, but my most worthwhile things have been the building of schools and medical clinics. That has given me more satisfaction than a footprint on a mountain, he heard Hillary say. As Greg listened, he felt a tap on his shoulder and turned around. A pretty woman with short hair was smiling at him. Her name, he would learn, was Tara Bishop. I knew who Greg was, she explained later. I'd heard about what he was trying to do, and I thought he had a great smile, so I sort of sidled up to him. Whispering so they wouldn't interrupt Hillary's speech, the two of them began to talk. By the time the speech was over, Greg knew he was in love. Tara had been wearing high heels, which I'd never really liked, he remembered. At the end of the night, her feet hurt, and she changed into a pair of combat boots. I don't know why that killed me, but it did. I felt like a teenager. Looking at her in that little dress and those big boots, I was positive she was the woman for me. At the end of the evening, they kissed for the first time. Welcome to my life, Tara said, pulling back to look Greg in the face. Welcome to my heart, he said, and wrapped her in his arms. He left the hotel that night with the promise of a year's salary, arm in arm with the woman he would marry. The next day, a Thursday, Tara drove Greg to the airport. He had tickets for a plane that would leave for Pakistan on Sunday, but together they told their story to the person working at the ticket counter and persuaded her to change the flight for 1 week later. She did it for free. They spent every moment of the next few days together. On Saturday, the couple drove to Santa Cruz, California, to see Greg's cousin Lana Peary and look at puppies. On the drive back on Sunday, Tara turned to look at Greg and asked, "So when are we getting married?" How's Tuesday? Greg said. On Tuesday, 6 days after they'd met, Greg and Tara got married at Oakland City Hall. They called up several friends, surprised them with the news, and told them to meet them at an Italian restaurant to celebrate. One friend was James Bullock, the operator of a cable car, and he took the couple on a private tour of San Francisco. Arm in arm with his wife, Greg Mortensen watched dazzling views of the Pacific and the Golden Gate Bridge. He realized that his cheeks felt tired, and he understood why. He'd been smiling for days. When people hear how I married Tara, they're always shocked, he said. But marrying her after 6 days doesn't seem strange to me. It's the kind of thing my parents did, and it worked for them. What's amazing to me is that I found the one person in the world I was meant to be with. The next Sunday, Tara took Greg to the airport again. But after they parked, he couldn't make himself leave the car. He turned to his wife, who was grinning. I'll ask, Greg said. But I don't know if they let me do it again. They did. Greg postponed his flight 2 more times. The agents at British Airways had heard about his romantic marriage, and they bent the rules to give Greg more time to get to know his new wife. It was a very special few weeks, a secret time, Greg remembered. No one knew I was still in town, and we just barricaded ourselves inside Tara's apartment, trying to make up for all the years we hadn't known each other. Finally, at the end of nearly 3 weeks together, Greg and Tara drove up to the airport once more. He kissed her goodbye and dragged his duffel bag to the ticket counter. You really want to go this time? The ticket agent teased. You're sure you're doing the right thing? Oh, I'm doing the right thing, Greg said and turned to wave one more time at his wife. I've never been this sure of anything. Chapter 12. Beginnings. Back in Skardu, Greg stood at the doorway to Changezi's office. A man with a club told him that Changezi was not there. When Greg held out the list of supplies that Changezi was supposed to be keeping, the man told him to come back in a month or two. Changezi would be back then. Then he tried to close the door. Greg was trying to decide whether to insist on getting his supplies or to find a policeman, when a dignified older man interrupted. His name was Ghulam Parvi, and he was an accountant Changezi had hired. Before coming to work for Changezi, he had been the director of a charity that had built two schools near Skardu. But the money had run out, and he'd been forced to take other jobs. Now he looked at Greg and asked in English, "Can I be of some assistance, sir?" Greg handed him the receipt for the supplies and explained what he needed them for. "I could waste my time with Changezi's ledgers for the next 2 weeks and still they would make no sense," said Parvi, wrapping a cream-colored scarf around his neck. "Shall we see what has become of your materials?" They drove to a building about a mile outside town where Changezi had stored the supplies for the school. But the building was fenced in, and the gate was locked. The next afternoon, Greg and Parvi returned, and this time Parvi had a bolt cutter. But now someone else was there, a guard armed with a rifle. "You can't go in," the man said in Balti. "This building has been sold. This Changezi may wear white robes, but I think he's an exceedingly black-souled man," Parvi said to Greg. He turned to the guard and argued angrily, and at last the guard gave way. When Parvi was about to cut the lock off, the man even got out a key. Inside, Parvi and Greg discovered about 2/3 of the supplies that Greg had asked Changezi to keep. He would never manage to find the rest, but this would be enough to start with. With Parvi's help, he arranged for what remained of the wood, cement, and tin to be sent to Corfe by jeep. "Without Parvi, I would have never accomplished anything in Pakistan," Greg said. "Parvi showed me how to get things done." Before setting out for Corfe on a jeep himself, Greg shook Parvi's hand warmly and thanked him for his help. "Let me know if I can be of further assistance," Parvi said with a slight bow. "What you're doing for the students of Baltistan is most laudable." Greg stood on a plain high above the Braldu River, gazing down at the site where Corfe's school was to be built. There was a pile of stones, looking like an ancient ruin. But the foundation, the floor of the school, was nowhere to be seen. Looking at the site with Haji Ali, Greg struggled to hide his disappointment. It was mid-October. They should at least be building the walls this week, but they couldn't start the walls without the foundation. Soon winter would be here. No one could work in the cold weather. Greg kicked a stone angrily. "What's the matter?" Haji Ali said in Balti. Greg took a deep breath. "Why haven't you started?" he asked. "Dr. Greg, we discussed your plan after you returned to your village," Haji Ali began. The chief explained that the villagers had decided it would be best if the men of Corfe cut the stone for the school themselves instead of spending Greg's money to hire workers from other villages. It took all summer because many of the men had to leave for porter work, the village chief explained. "But don't worry, I have your money safely locked in my home." "I'm not worried about the money," Greg said, "but I wanted to get a roof up before winter so the children would have some place to study." Haji put his hand on Greg's shoulder and gave his impatient American friend a friendly squeeze. "I thank all-merciful Allah for what you have done. But the people of Corfe have been here without a school for 600 years. What is one winter more?" That night, lying on Haji Ali's roof next to Twaha, Greg thought of how lonely he'd been the last time he'd slept on the spot. He pictured Tara, remembering how she had waved at him through the airport window, and he couldn't keep his happiness to himself.
"Twaha, you awake?"
Greg asked.
"Yes, awake. I have to tell you something. I got married."
Greg heard a click. Then he found himself squinting into the beam of the flashlight he'd brought as a present for his friend. Twaha sat up next to him, studying his face to see if he was joking. Then he dropped the flashlight to the ground and pounded Greg on the arms and shoulders to congratulate him. Twaha collapsed onto his pile of blankets with a happy sigh. Haji Ali say Dr. Greg look different this time, Twaha said laughing. He really know everything. Can I know her good name?
Tara.
Tara. Ah, yes, it means star in our language. It's a good star to come make you happy. She's lovely, you Tara?
Yes, said Greg, blushing. Lovely.
How many goat and ram you must give her father? Twaha asked. In Balti culture, the bride's father must give the groom's family a bride price, called a dowry, a payment of animals, sacks of flour, bags of sugar and more, when two people get married.
Her father is dead like mine, Greg explained. And in America, we don't pay a bride price.
Did she cry when she left her mother?
She only told her mother about me after we were married.
Twaha was silent for a moment, considering the strange marriage customs of Americans. The next morning, Sakina boiled an egg, a rare and precious item, for Greg's breakfast, and served it to him, along with his chapati and lassi. Haji Ali waited patiently while Greg finished his second cup of tea. Then he grinned.
Let's go build a school, he said. After a prayer at the mosque, a building of Muslim worship, Haji Ali and Greg made marks on the ground where the walls of the school would go. 50 men, including Greg, took turns with 5 shovels until they had dug a trench to be filled with cement. When the trench was done, 6 men carried 2 large stones over to the corner of the trench that faced Corfi K2. The stones had been specially carved to be cornerstones for the school. Then Haji Ali called for the village's prize ram, the biggest and best male sheep. This animal, the most valuable one in the village, was killed as a sacrifice to bless the beginning of the school. The meat was shared with all the people of Corfe. We didn't get anything else done that day, Greg said. In fact, we hardly got anything else done that fall. We just had a massive feast. For people who may only get meat a few times a year, that meal was a much more serious business than a school. After the feast, Greg and a group of men built a large fire in what would one day be the courtyard of the finished school. They danced around the fire and sang traditional songs while the women of the village clapped along. That night, Greg realized that, though he might not get to finish the school before he had to return home, it had finally become real to him. By Thanksgiving, Greg was back in California. He and Tara spent the holiday with Jean Herney and his wife.
Listen, Herney said. You love what you're doing in the Himalayas, and it doesn't sound like you're too bad at it. Why don't you make a career? The children of those other villages that try to bribe you need schools, too. What if I endowed a foundation and made you the director? You could build a school every year. What do you say?
Greg squeezed his wife's hand. The idea felt so right he was afraid to say anything. Afraid Herney would change his mind. But Herney didn't. Many things changed for Greg over that winter. He and Tara left California and moved into a small house in Bozeman, Montana. Tara became pregnant, and Herney's foundation became a reality. By the time Greg returned to Pakistan in May, it was as the director of the Central Asia Institute, or CAI. As director, he could afford to hire some help. Back in Pakistan, Greg contacted Musafer, the porter who had helped him make his way down from K2. He offered Musafer a steady salary if he'd come to Corfe to help with the school. Greg hired Ghulam Parvi as well.
I could see the greatness of Greg's heart right away, said Parvi. We both wanted the same things for Baltistan's children. How could I refuse such a man?
When he arrived in Corfe on a Friday afternoon, Greg crossed the bridge and was surprised to meet a group of Corfe's women, dressed in their best clothes, walking the other way. They were going to visit their families in neighboring villages. Without the bridge, it had been difficult for them to walk so far. Now that they could get there and back in an afternoon, the women started regular Friday visits to their families in other villages. The bridge made the women feel a whole lot happier and less isolated. Who knew that something as simple as a bridge could empower women? Greg explains. Haji Ali welcomed Greg back with a hug. Standing behind him was Musafer, looking as if he didn't feel well. Greg hugged him too. How are you? He asked in Balti. He found out over dinner that, after the only road between Corfe and Skardu had been blocked by a landslide, Musafir had led a party of porters carrying 90-pound bags of cement to the village. He had made the trip more than 20 times, skipping meals and walking day and night, so that the cement would be waiting when Greg arrived. When I first met Mr. Greg Mortensen on the Baltoro, he was a very friendly talking lad, Musafir said, always joking and sharing his heart with a poor person like the porters. When I lost him and thought he might die out on the ice, I was awake all night praying to Allah that I might be allowed to save him, and when I found him again, I promised to protect him forever with all my strength. I am poor and can only offer him my prayer, also the strength of my back. This I gladly gave him so he could build his school. Chapter 13. Haji Ali's Lesson. The next morning, before it got light, Greg paced back and forth on the roof of Haji Ali's house. Now he was the director of a foundation, not just one climber trying to help one village. He had responsibilities. He owed it to Jean Herney to do this right. He was determined to get the school finished as quickly as possible. Everyone gathered at the construction site. With dynamite, they blasted large boulders into smaller chunks of stone. Then dozens of people would carry the stones to masons, skilled stone, brick, and cement workers, who would shape them into neat bricks with a few blows of a chisel. Women carried water from the river and used it to mix cement in large holes in the ground. The walls were built with the stone bricks and the cement, and children put slivers of stone into gaps between the bricks. "We were all very excited to help," said Tahira, the daughter of Hussein, the teacher. She was 10 years old when the construction began. "My father told me the school would be something very special, but I had no idea then what a school was, so I came to see what everyone was so excited about, and to help. Everyone in my family helped." "Dr. Greg brought books from his country," said Haji Ali's granddaughter Jahan, who was 9 at the time. "And they had pictures of schools in them, so I had some idea of what we were helping to build. I thought Dr. Greg was very distinguished with his clean clothes, and the children in the pictures looked very clean too. And I remember thinking, if I go to the school, maybe one day I can become distinguished too." All through June, the school walls rose steadily, but not fast enough for Greg. The men needed to take care of their crops and their animals, so they could not spend all their time on the school. Everything went slowly. "I spend all day at the construction site from sunrise to sunset," Greg said. "I always had my notebook in my hand and kept my eyes on everyone, anxious to account for every rupee. I didn't want to disappoint Jean Herney, so I drove people hard." One day in August, Haji Ali appeared at the construction site. He tapped Greg on the shoulder and asked him to take a walk. He led the American up to a narrow ledge high above the village. Greg felt time slipping away, worried about the tasks going on below that he couldn't supervise from here. Haji Ali told Greg to take a look at the view. Icy mountain peaks knived into the sky. Below them, Corfe, green with fields of ripening barley, looking small and vulnerable. Haji Ali laid his hand on Greg's shoulder. "These mountains have been here for a long time," he said, "and so have we. You can't tell the mountains what to do. You must learn to listen to them. So now I'm asking you to listen to me. By the mercy of Almighty Allah, you have done much for my people, and we appreciate it. But now you must do one thing more for me." "Anything," Greg said. "Sit down and shut your mouth," said Haji Ali. "You're making everyone crazy." Then he reached out and took my plumb line and my level and my account book, and he walked back down to Corfe, Greg remembered. I followed him all the way to his house, worried about what he was doing. He took the key he always kept around his neck on a leather thong, opened a cabinet decorated with faded Buddhist wood carvings, and locked my things in there. Then he asked Sakina to bring us tea. For half an hour, Greg fidgeted while Sakina brewed tea and Haji Ali looked through his Quran, the most precious thing he owned. When the cups of tea steamed in their hands, Haji Ali spoke. If you want to thrive in Baltistan, you must respect our ways, he said, blowing on his tea. The first time you share tea with a Balti, you're a stranger. The second time you take tea, you're an honored guest.